Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike Vassop, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Our guest this week is Luke Crumley, Director of Public Policy and Nutrient Management at Ohio Corn and Wheat, an organization working towards opportunities for long-term Ohio corn and small grain grower profitability. They do this through several checkoff groups and associations that expand markets, fund research, provide education, and advocate for supportive public policy on behalf of farmer members. Despite being surrounded by agriculture growing up in Ohio, it wasn't an intimate part of Luke's upbringing, particularly because this was the mid-80s towards the end of the farming crisis, where his parents were forced to sell. Much of the culture and its surroundings were, however, very much a part of Luke's personality and his character traits, particularly the sense of service. For Luke, it was first military service in the Marine Corps, and then public service with several congressional offices before joining Ohio Corn and Wheat. His time as a battalion adjutant in the Marine Corps taught him things like the gravity of a situation, how to operate in what he calls a pressure cooker environment, and the need to prioritize. This ability to prioritize specifically is something he's brought forward to Ohio Corn and Wheat, essentially helping growers put resources where they need to be to affect mission-critical issues. Have a listen as Luke connects the dots between these different times in his life. We also get into his experiences with carbon markets and how these programs are, or are not, addressing the primary concerns of their target market.
I had a pretty standard Midwest upbringing, I think. And what I mean by that is I grew up here in Ohio at the time, referred to as the Rust Belt. You saw a significant decline in industry over the 80s, 90s. You saw farm communities collapse in the 80s. It's what happened to my dad's family. They lost the farm. They had to sell it off in the 80s. So I grew up really kind of on the rebound of that. Born in the mid 80s, my parents had both been married before. They came into Columbus. They met each other. I grew up here on the southwest side of Columbus, Ohio. My parents both work in blue collar jobs. I was a first generation college student. Really pretty standard story that you get a lot out of the Midwest for folks in my millennial generation, right? Went to a small private school here in central Ohio and then ended up deciding to go off to the Marine Corps. But the real remarkable thing was that I had no exposure to the agriculture community that was so abundant around Columbus itself. You know, if you drive 5 minutes west of where I grew up, you land at a place where they have one of the biggest farm shows in the Midwest called Farm Science Review. I grew up just down the road from it and didn't know about it until I started working in the industry here, you know, 20 years later. So, I've always found that really insightful for how, you know, siloed our communities can be. You know, our suburban and urban communities can be so far removed from the 1% of the population that's producing the food, fuel, and fiber that they need. And I'm living proof of that. My family farmed and I didn't. And because of that, I had no idea about the industry. Hopefully that answers a little bit of the background.
It does. Do you think the fact that your father had to sell the farm in the mid 80s had to do with maybe you not having any exposure to it growing up, despite being surrounded by it?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We had my grandmother living in a home still adjacent to the property that my dad grew up farming. And it wasn't a big operation by today's standards. Back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 240 acres was a pretty sizable operation, right? And anytime, you know, my dad and I would go down to do our weekend with grandma and help her around, you know, do the grocery shop and all of that, he would take me out and show me part of the property. We would walk the fields. He'd tell me the stories about, you know, disking the fields and how they work through crop rotation and what it was like working those long days and those hard hours. And he really tried to instill some knowledge of it, get me some exposure, take me out while planting and harvest was going on, and at least see the activity. So, you know, he tried to at least instill an appreciation, and he was successful at that. You know, I've always had just so much tremendous respect for the folks who are in production ag, because folks just don't understand the decisions that these business owners have to make. You know, these really personal life legacy decisions that they're making on a daily basis. So, you know, I'm glad I got the exposure that I did. I wish there had been more, but yeah, it definitely played a role.
Was he honest with you in that exposure about the realities of its difficulty as a profession?
I think so. You know, by that point, my dad himself had been, you know, by the time I was, you know, conscious enough to really have those conversations, right, he had been removed from farming life himself for 10, 15 years at this point. So it wasn't as pointed, as acute for him at that point, you know, because he was experiencing that blue collar work here in Central Ohio, working in shipping and manufacturing worlds, right? Very different day-to-day experience. And you lose that insight of the farm, even though it was a formative experience for him. It's tough to tell.
Did you, you haven't described yet a military background as a family. Where did that impetus come from to come into the Marine Corps in college?
And, you know, there wasn't much in my immediate family. My dad did not have to serve due to, you know, health issues when it would have been his time potentially in the Vietnam era. My grandfather on that side was a sheriff during World War II. So, you know, I didn't have that direct link. I had cousins for sure who had been in the Air Force. Or were actively serving in the Air Force. In fact, you know, Ohio has a tremendous Air Force footprint because of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base here, which accounts for about 80% of the Air Force budget flowing through Air Force Materiel Command here in Ohio. But I knew pretty early on that I wanted to serve in some way. You know, as early as eighth grade, I knew that in some way I wanted to be in public service, right? And, you know, as you get a little older, you start thinking about politics, right? You start thinking about, oh, maybe someday I could run for office. And I remember my dad having a very clear conversation with me about this. He said, this is as I was in college and starting to think about, you know, future opportunities, internships, whatever. He said, Luke, I know that you want to serve in this way, but I think before you ever consider about elective service, I think you should serve first. And that was, you know, very brutally down to the basic level. I think you should put on the uniform first, because I think you're going to learn something through whatever branch that's going to prepare you, that's going to make you better. And it's going to give you a bigger appreciation for what those elected officials, the decisions that they make and the ramifications that they have, right? So my dad pushed me. I don't think he expected me to join the Marine Corps. I certainly don't think he expected me to do it after college and to go on and serve as a commissioned officer. I know he's proud of what I did, but I'm the first Marine and the first commissioned officer in my family. So it's pretty big break in the trends.
In hindsight, the perspective of military service prior to public service, in order to give a sense of what it meant, you think that was the right call? Do you look back on that and say, what was probably the key thing that you drew from military service that you have brought forward into public service?
Gravity. The first answer, yes, it was absolutely the right call. When I think about my career trajectory since then, you know, do I sometimes think, huh, did this stunt my professional development in this particular field? Maybe. Who knows? Who knows if I had had four more years here working in local politics in Ohio? Who knows what path I would have taken? But when I think about what I gained out of my time in uniform, the exposure to more folks from across the country and more culture outside of Ohio. When I think about the heft of a 21-year-old, 22-year-old being responsible for his Marines, and you and I both know what that really means. It means responsible for their life and livelihood. You know, officers take on a specific commitment to be accountable for everything that happens under their command. And that forces you to grow up really quickly. You know, here I was as a brand new lieutenant briefing the 2nd Marine Division General my second weekend down at Camp Lejeune, knowing nothing about anything, but having a real responsibility there to step into a position and speak with authority. You don't get that in any other environment. You don't get that pressure cooker that I talk about. I wrote about it on my blog this past week. That pressure cooker environment is so unique. And I'm not saying unique to the Marine Corps, I'm saying unique to those in service, because I guarantee our brothers in the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Coast Guard all have, and I got to say Space Force now too, all have that same mission weight around them, right? And there's nothing like it. And I'm really glad I listened to my dad and followed his advice. I'm glad I went to the Marine Corps. That caught a lot of people off guard. You know, had you met me in high school, no one would have probably ever thought that that was the branch I would have landed in. But there's something about the culture of the Marine Corps that really appealed to me. And I wouldn't trade my experience for the world.
No, I can certainly appreciate that, having been in somewhat of a similar career trajectory path as a Marine officer myself. This idea of a pressure cooker environment instilling in you a sense of gravity in a particular situation, I appreciate. I think some folks who are listening appreciate. The thing that often doesn't get talked about that's a byproduct of those stressful situations, without a lot of experience, to be honest, are the mistakes that come from that. Can you talk about perhaps a mistake that you had made in that particular environment that you have now looked at on or with a different set of glasses, so to speak?
I mean, the hardest and one of the earliest lessons that I think I had to learn as a staff officer was prioritization. And, you know, I was an adjutant, and you and I have talked about this. You know, as the adjutant, as the S1 officer, you are immediately surrounded by the top three people in a battalion: the battalion commander, the XO, and the sergeant major. And you're in the headshed with them, and you're exposed to the entire decision-making process. Because you have to be, as a primary officer, and by just where your real estate is. And when you're really early in that time, when you're, you know, really young as an adjutant, it is tough to discern between what is important and what's a priority, what is necessary and what's mission critical. And then what are you communicating to the people that need to know about it? And I made some decisions that I thought were just about my Marines and my shop that ended up having implications across companies, and not realizing how all that played together, had to get reined in a little bit. You know, had to learn, had to grow up, and had to learn that, you know, what I thought was mission critical for my shop needs to translate to what's actually mission critical for the battalion. So without getting into too many specifics, you know, that I think that lesson was the most important that I picked up really early on. And I'll always remember my battalion commander. You know, I'm going to credit him. I'm sure I had heard it before and by other Marine officers since. But he would repeatedly say, if everything's a priority, nothing's a priority. And that's a really important concept, I think, especially for advocacy organizations in my work now, for politicians, for the average citizen. You know, we're bombarded by the news, by the 24-hour news cycle, by every crisis that comes our way. You know, when I think about the guys and gals in production ag here in Ohio, every day could bring a new crisis, right? whether it's water quality issues with Lake Erie, whether it's tax policy that's being discussed in Washington, if it's markets and, you know, the effect of COVID on grain prices, every day they're facing a crisis potentially. But within organizations like Ohio Corn and Wheat and the other commodity groups, we're there to help work through what's actually a priority, drawing information from our growers on what's most important to them so we can actually put resources where they need to be to affect mission critical issues, right? And that lesson has just flowed all through, whether it was my time working for a couple members of Congress here in Ohio or now with Ohio Corn and Wheat, that lesson on priorities just continues to ring true.
Was it a struggle for you to have to sort of transition how you pulled information from the bottom or from your growers, whereas as an adjutant with a staff, you're not necessarily reaching down in a lot of cases to make decisions, but in this instance, you're pulling those priorities from the people you serve. Was that a difficult transition for you coming from military service to the advocacy program?
I hadn't thought of it like that, but I think you're onto something there. So with the hierarchy within any branch of service, you know, the priority is set at the top, right? And then how that priority gets executed is delegated down the chain of command. But, you know, now where I am at Ohio Corn and Wheat, we are a grassroots driven organization. It's not the staff dictating from on high what needs to happen. It's we need to know what our growers give a damn about. And, you know, we have to be very strategic about that. And we have to get surveys out to them. We have to, you know, be out in the fields hearing directly from them. We have to be constantly trying to draw information from them to be able to shape that day-to-day, month-to-month, year-to-year work. So, you know, whereas my battalion commander could say, there's the target. You're going to go do this, right? Mm-hmm. And here's my end state. Now it's, okay, growers, what are you concerned about? We listen, we come up with a framework that says, here's what we've heard. Is this right? Is this directionally accurate in the way you want us to proceed? And then we go after it. But it's a lot more work to draw up than to be told, hey, go attack that hill, right?
Yeah. Do you think that the veteran, generally speaking, has developed a set of skills or is uniquely qualified to succeed in the agricultural advocacy space?
Yes. Because there are very few entities that can train you to be a team member quite like the Department of Defense can, right? And advocacy is really, it's a team sport. And it's constantly trying to bring new team members on. It's trying to improve the skill sets of your team members. It's you're not trying to necessarily win a game, right? But you are trying to advance the ball down the field constantly. And you can't do that without a full team around you. So I do think from that perspective, yes, there's an understanding of how to work and partner together. I also think the weight of service does grow you up, like we talked about earlier. And I do think that the average guy or gal with 5 to 10 years of service in uniform is going to be able to handle the stressors of politics better than some other folks. But the big but, we are very mission oriented in DOD, and we're very mission accomplishment oriented. I mean, you remember this as a Marine officer. What were we told? Mission accomplishment first, troop welfare second, right? Mm-hmm. Constantly driving that concept of accomplish this mission or else, right? It is really difficult to accomplish a mission in public policy. The work is never quite done because as soon as you get something codified in the rulemaking process, well, a bill gets introduced to wipe it all away, right? And now you have a whole new fight.
Can you connect the dots for the listeners with respect to how you moved from a battalion adjutant into the Ohio Corn and Wheat Organization?
Who knows? Honestly, I feel incredibly blessed to be where I am because, you know, having not worked in ag before, having just that minimal exposure, most people would write me off as not really a contender for this position, but what did I actually bring? So yes, I had my time in uniform and I got to work with a very small team. I got to manage a small team. I got to deal with a lot of crazy issues. You know, an average battalion adjutant actually has like 18 jobs that they're responsible for, right? I was our battalion prosecutor and our mailman. So like that's all over the board here, right? And that ability to operate independently and react to like 1,000 different things at once and prioritize them, really helpful, right? But I left my time in uniform to come back here to Ohio to go to the Ohio State University to do my master's program. And about 2 weeks into my master's program, I get a call from a buddy who is also a Marine. He had been working for a member of Congress here in the area. He said, "Hey, I'm moving on to something else, but I think you'd be a great fit for this. Would you be interested in interviewing?" Hell yeah. Of course I would. So I came in, interviewed a couple rounds, then got to sit down with the congressman who I'd already met previously, who I'd volunteered on, parades for or whatever. He didn't know me from Adam. It's a big operation. But after about a 12-minute conversation with him, he hired me on the spot. And he hired me to work in constituent services. And that's not in DC. Constituent services is work back in the home district.
Okay.
And those are the folks who work for a member of Congress who help a constituent in need. So when I got hired, my specific portfolio was military and veterans issues. And if someone had a problem with the VA, if someone had a problem with their retirement benefits, if someone was struggling to get a copy of their personnel record, you know, we were there, I was there to help them navigate those bureaucratic processes, right? So I started off doing that, was doing that full-time while going to grad school full-time, 40 pounds later, I was able to graduate and really dive into constituent work. I was able to jump into a campaign role. I was the political director on a campaign, three different campaigns for that member of Congress. And in that role, I got exposure to grassroots work, you know, helping recruit volunteers, keeping volunteers engaged, managing projects again remotely, but getting exposed to talking more in public about issues. And as I continued to snowball my experience with that member of Congress, he kept throwing more and more opportunities at me to dive into policy when that was available, to dive into community engagement when that was available. And now here I am at Ohio Corn and Wheat. And what do? I work on policy development. I work on grassroots management. I run our political action committee for Ohio Corn and Wheat. I manage all of our recruitment efforts for those things, right? I dabble in communications and try to put the political eyepiece on our communications work. So the flow is really all the way back from my time in uniform through working for a member of the House, now at Ohio Corn and Wheat. You have all of these themes that have been consistent. One title, but a lot of jobs, constantly having to build rapport with outside stakeholders, external stakeholders, and bring people to the table, and really continuing to grow my own concepts of leadership, because oftentimes I have to lead initiatives on my own. And that was, I hope that connected the dots enough. It was a weird path for sure.
So the grower then communicates their concerns and considerations and points of advocacy to the broader organization like Ohio Corn and Wheat, who takes mm-hmm. all of those different concerns together and formalizes a priority that then tries to execute some of those priorities through political advocacy, through checkoff programs, et cetera.
On the Growers Association side, for sure. Anything that falls on even remotely into legislative or government work, that's housed in the association because it has to be kept separate. And we are really strict about that.
Yeah.
But say a grower comes to us and says, "Hey, I've seen a problem with vomitoxin this year, and I want my checkoff dollars to go into researching how we can prevent it." Okay. Well, that belongs to the checkoff, right? Where these strike teams came in, really valuable, is that we were able to look at the whole organization and who has responsibility for what aspect of this problem. And there may be a policy issue that needs to be discussed, but it needs to be informed by growers who are having the experience, right? So you have this churn of information within mm-hmm. these strike teams that really helped us get spun up on these issues really quickly and launch into actual activity, which was really good. I'm really proud of what happened with those strike teams over the past 6 months.
On this strike team that pertains particularly to carbon mm-hmm. and carbon markets, two mm-hmm. considerations from the grower's perspective that I hear on carbon markets are, it's another commodity market. Why would I want to be a part of that? Mm-hmm. The second one is that the contracts that they're getting from some of these companies lock them into a 10, 15, 20 year type commitment. That's point number two. I think the third point is that growers who have already been doing regenerative practices aren't the target customer for these markets. They're yeah. ones who are converting because there are incentives to convert. What are your thoughts on those kind of key?
Welcome to day one of carbon markets. I mean, those are the questions that come up in every single conversation. You know, I also sit on the stewardship action team for NCGA. I engage with the Environmental Research Committee for National Association of Wheat Growers. And every conversation I have in every context, those are the first three things that come up. Okay. To the commodity point, I would argue that it's not yet a commodity, and that's mm-hmm. the problem. We can't understand it because we don't have an actual value for agricultural credits yet. There has not yet been a single agricultural credit sold for us to figure out what the market price is. The only carbon credits that are out there are forestry credits. And forestry is graded much more favorably for those credits because when you plant a tree, you're planting it for 100 years.
Yeah.
When you plant a row of corn, you're planting it for the growth cycle, right? And there's no guarantee that from an agronomic perspective that the grower won't have to till up the field, say, because of weather conditions in a given year. So agricultural credits are going to have a much lower value from the get-go. But we don't know what the value is because the market doesn't exist yet. And there's a bill at the federal level that's trying to address this to a degree called the Growing Climate Solutions Act, which I think folks should take a look at. It sets up some barriers. It basically says USDA will have the ability to figure out what practices are acceptable and how they should be treated within a given market to try to bring some clarity. Because it's not a true commodity market yet.
You're right? Saying that none of these marketplaces established now by Indigo or Corteva, none of these are
They're paying consumers,
right?
They're paying the farmer, and they're generating these credits now, right?
Right.
But the market hasn't developed fully, and the sales aren't happening yet.
Oh, back to
the credits.
Got it.
Being generated. Got the payment it. To the grower might be happening. But we are, maybe in the last couple of months, maybe there have been some, I don't know. I'm not following it on a day-to-day basis, for sales. Right. But the point is still, it's so young. It's so, I mean, these things are like barely out of the womb, if at all. There's a lot of growing to do before growers, I think, are going to be able to feel comfortable that it is actually a commodity. And then they might actually be more willing to engage. But to your second point about the length of these contracts, comes up every single time, because agronomically, what if I have to till up my field, right? What's the penalty going to be for my operation? What am I going to lose if I have to do this? And we could spend all day talking about this because this comes up in, again, every single conversation, massive concern. And the best I can tell a grower is make sure you read the fine print. I will say that some of those programs that are coming out are starting to respond to that concern a little bit and shortening the term of the contract. But until you can get a commitment for 10 plus years, the value of what you're selling is going to be diminished. Mm-hmm. Again, compare it to those forestry markets. 100 years for a tree. You're sequestering that carbon for 100 years. That's predictable value. What if I have to till next year? Well, you just lost a whole lot of value for that credit. Yeah.
It almost seems like
big problem.
It almost seems like the shortening of the contracts is a way to garner user adoption, but mm-hmm. over the course of the life of that cover crop or whatever it is, you're not reaping the true value of that, because mm-hmm. the only way you do that is through time and tenure. And right now the ag credit market isn't in place like it is for the mm-hmm. forestry one, or it's even as valuable mm-hmm. as the forestry one. That's an interesting perspective.
You know who does have an advantage, though, and there could be value for this long term, is the ethanol sector and the biodiesel sector, because the factories, the plants that actually produce those products could capture the carbon that's coming out of their stacks and pipe it directly into the earth low enough that they could have a really valuable credit. It's not the same when you're talking about roots for plants. It's just not.
So, it's so much harder to predict. The modeling is mm-hmm. is there, but it's not mm-hmm. as accurate as it should be. There are a lot of assumptions. You're not really taking into account field variability. I mean, it's a mm-hmm. hard ass problem.
It's a mess. It's a mess. Yeah. And no one uses the same protocols.
Nope.
You know, they're luckily here in Ohio, we have a professor at Ohio State, Dr. Ratan Lal, who is a world-renowned expert on carbon. And he points this out. Everyone knows how to measure carbon. Like, we know how to tell it's there. The real question is measuring carbon stock and what's actually being sequestered through the growth cycle and how far is it getting down into the soil. And if it gets down to about 2 feet deep in Ohio soils, it's probably not going to come back out. Mm-hmm. We can say that pretty confidently. But if it's only going down like 6 inches in a year, you're going to need a longer contract to make that thing worthwhile, right? Now, early adopters and the folks who have been doing the stewardship work and adopting these best practices long-term, they may have carbon well down in their soil that they've sequestered. But that carbon to a carbon credit purchaser is absolutely worthless, because it's not new carbon being sequestered. It's stuff that's already been done. And it's a term called additionality. And additionality is really a driving factor in this space. Additionality is going to hamper, I won't say cripple, but it's going to hamper adoption for sure. Everywhere? No. There are watersheds here in Ohio where you have cover crop adoption. And that's not to say cropping is the end all be all of carbon sequestration, but just as one practice, we have watersheds here that have less than 5% adoption of cover crops. There's a target rich environment for them to adopt and maybe get some credits, right? What about the 5% who have been doing it? Are they going to till up their fields and greenwash so that now they can start getting these credits?
Don't say that.
Now you have an externality.
Gosh.
My friend.
The
economists are going to have a heyday with this thing. It's massively complex. And my advice to a grower, don't feel like you have to rush. These things are developing. If it's right for your farm, that's a decision for you to make. If you think that you want to try this on a portion of your farm, look for a program that requires a certain amount of acres and not necessarily your whole farm, right? Mm-hmm. Try it out. There is, just like an advocacy, there's room enough for everyone to play. Scale it to your operation, scale it to what you've already adopted. You know, most of these programs have a suite of practices that count for carbon sequestration, and many of them you can stack multiple practices on. We've had a ton of success in the last 2 years here in Ohio with something called H2 Ohio. It's not a carbon program. It's a water quality program, and it's focused on the Western Lake Erie Basin and preventing agricultural runoff. H2 Ohio, from in its first year, last year, of user enrollment, we enrolled 1 million acres in a year. Over 1,800 growers are participating. And there are abilities to stack credits where you can get pretty sizable payments. If so, say you're doing a cover crop, you can even have a harvestable. I'm mixing up terms here, but you can have a small grain cover crop that counts towards a stackable credit. And that makes soft red winter wheat a pretty attractive third crop rotation where you can go and do double crop soybeans after it, right? That's pretty great. Hmm. That now makes the prospect of keeping organic matter in the soil pretty palatable. Find a program that gives you that kind of flexibility. Don't feel like you have to rush into it. You're not being mandated to do this right now. In fact, all of the national organizations, to my knowledge, are continuously advocating for voluntary adoption because they know growers have to have experience with this. They have to test. They have to try it out and develop those new best practices on their own fields. I hope anyone listening to this has not fallen asleep as I've been talking about it. It's really complex. It is going to require sobriety as you look at it. It's going to require patience as it develops because this thing is going to change dramatically over the next 5 years.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you or that we haven't talked about that I should or that we should be aware of?
Well, you haven't asked me what on earth is going on with the infrastructure bill, but that's fine. Because no one knows. But jokes aside, you know, if I could leave any one lasting thought with the folks who are listening, I know I sound like an eternal optimist when politics seems so draining, when politics seems so rife for division and strife. It can sometimes be a bit Pollyannish, maybe, how I talk about it. I believe we are better together, period. It's how I was raised. You know, I may not have been raised on the farm, but I think some of those farm mentalities came through pretty strong. And when you think about your farm community, when you think about your county, what happens when there's a death in a family? Everyone comes together. Everyone helps out. Everyone pitches in. I would say that the ag industry is at a point that it's never seen before in the world. For 10,000 years, the vast majority of humans were engaged in day-to-day food production.
Fact.
We're at a point where less than 1% of our nation is engaged in food production. The average consumer doesn't know what you're doing on your fields. They have misconceptions. They don't know the challenges that you face as a businessman, and they don't care. Your family is in danger. Your family, your community is on the table, not at the table right now. And until you are willing to make those small investments, 20 minutes at a time to learn just a little bit more about how to talk about your issues, how to talk to someone about your issues, how to share your own story. Until you're willing to do that, we have a massively uphill battle. And, you know, the gravity of the situation is real. People are making decisions in Washington about your business and you're not at the table. And we have to change it. We have to change it. We can't afford not to.
There's a perception in the community that it's outsiders don't belong, mm-hmm. right? And I disagree with that on a lot of different levels. Just, I think mm-hmm. also from my experience in the service and how that kind of mentality just doesn't work. And the way you just described how growers are on the table and not at the table, I think in part is because of this mentality. And you and I talked about it on our first conversation was that there almost, you know, feels like there has to be this justification when you talk to somebody with an ag that, well, I didn't, you have to caveat it with, was that, well, I wasn't involved in ag, but you have to try to make some connection to it as if yeah. to try to bring yourself back into the trust tree, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it that's a mentality that can only be changed from within. And the onus to do that has to happen from within.
Mm-hmm. I've had a really great example here in Ohio. His name's Mark, and he was a grower who was on the board, transitioning off the board as I got hired. And my very first time meeting the board, Mark pulls me aside during a break. He says, "We want you to be wildly successful. You have more people in that room rooting for you than you realize. And it doesn't matter what your background is. Just charge after it." That's what I needed to hear. But that's what all of ag needs to hear right now, too.
What a great way to end it, Luke. We'll just leave it at that. Luke's stories of how he's using this skill set from the Marine Corps at Ohio Corn and Wheat are some of the clearest examples of how to transition a non-technical skill set into the private sector. This ability to prioritize what's important and to pull information from those you serve is what makes up his daily life today. Really getting to the bottom of issues that growers give a damn about and directing resources towards it. Luke also describes advocacy as a team sport, and very few entities can train you to be a team member like the Department of Defense. Our conversation around carbon markets is one of the more insightful ones on the topic that I've had. We talk about the three most common concerns that he sees in the carbon market space that come up in almost every grower conversation he has. Carbon as a commodity market. Incentives to convert are only present for new practitioners. And contract lengths. Luke acknowledges that these practices are very new and advises growers to read the fine print about contract lengths and to not rush into anything. Try a program out first and scale it into your operation. Ag today is at a place right now where farmers are on the table, not at it. We all need to charge after this problem, change negative perceptions from within, and advocate for our own well-being. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these stories and insights, please leave us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website at agdconsult.com. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike Dessau, and until next time, stay frosty.